happy duty to introduce to you my friend and colleague, Christoph Koch, this year's Templeton Research Lecture speaker. He will be speaking today on the problem of consciousness in philosophy, religion, and science. You're in for a treat. Christoph is one of those rare scientists who has the courage and knowledge to deal with the big questions. Christoph studied physics and philosophy in Tübingen, Germany. He earned a PhD from the Max Planck Institute for Biological Cybernetics in 1982, working with Valentin Freytenberg and Tommaso Poggio. He spent 4 years at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in the Artificial Intelligence Laboratory and the Department of Brain and Cognitive Science. From there, in 1986, he was appointed an assistant professor at Caltech when they launched their new doctoral program in computation and neural systems. He is now the the Louise and Victor Trundle Professor of Cognitive and Behavioral Biology. Now, Christoph's research and scholarly pursuits have a unique scope and depth that I want to share with you briefly. He supervises research that extends from electrical engineering inspired by brain circuits. So, for example, he has a patent for a device called a pulse domain neuromorphic integrated circuit for computing motion. He studies the biophysics of brain function to understand how brain cells communicate with each other. A title of a recent paper is Spike Propagation in Dendrites with Stochastic Ion Channels. This will not be on a test. His laboratory also studies visual perception. A recent paper is entitled Depth of Interocular Suppression Associated with Flash Suppression and Binocular Rivalry, co-authored with our own Randolph Blake. And this is why he's here today, he studies consciousness and the brain basis of consciousness. All of you who are interested in this topic, I recommend Christoph's book, The Quest for Consciousness, A Neurobiological Approach. It appeared in 2004. The group has read it, studied it. It has now been translated into Japanese, French, Spanish, and German. Now, for a talk like this on consciousness, I would be remiss if I did not pause to remember Christoph's longtime colleague, Francis Crick, whose passing in 2004 touched many of us. Francis and Christoph published a series of papers and chapters from 1990 through 2005 that legitimized the scientific study of consciousness and captured the imagination, inspired the work of neuroscientists, psychologists, and computer scientists. I'm sure that you will be as captured, your imagination will be as captured today, so I hope you'll join me in welcoming Christoph Koch.
From a philosophical point of view and briefly from a religious point of view and then from a scientific point of view. I won't really talk too much about the science of consciousness. I'll leave that for tomorrow, showing you illusions and sort of the research that people now, that we and other people can do in a lab to study, or in a clinic to study the neural basis of consciousness. And then in a couple of weeks from now, I'll return to the question of free will, which is one of the core questions of relating to consciousness and how can it be studied in a lab. and what can we say about free will? Is free will an illusion or not? And what? How does that impact our belief in the answer to the question, the answers to the question of free will? How does it impact our belief in God and our sense of religiosity? I love tattoos. I have a tattoo of a Macintosh on my bicep, and I found a couple of weeks ago, I was staying in Zurich. I found an engineer and philosopher who has this tattooed onto his bicep, and it epitomizes what I'm interested in, what I'll talk to you about, which is the epsilon stands for epistemology, which is what can we know, what can we, given that we are humans, we have sensory apparatuses. We have eyes and ears, and they're not perfect, and they are maybe only allow us to infer certain things. What is it that we can reasonably know about the universe? Then there is the oath ontology, which is the science of what there is. So this is one of the key questions that we should all be, and most of us at some point, certainly before we entered graduate school, were interested in, namely the question of what is out there. I mean, what is really out there? Is there, for example, is there something that we can really say about it? Is there a notion such as the truth? And do we know the truth? When we find it? And, you know, metaphysical question, particularly the question of God, the question of what happened, you know, what happens, where do we come from, where are we going? So these are all questions relating to the ontology. And then lastly, the pi stands for phenomenology, which is what psychologists study, which is what we all do all the time, namely we experience things. And in a lab, you can study, you can just enjoy, you can have your beer and enjoy the experience of the beer, of the beautiful red sunset, or you can study it in a lab. And so this is what's known as phenomenology, which is the appearance of things, right? And so what science is, what many of us in scientists study is the relationship between what can we know, what is there to how do things appear, and ultimately what is really there. And of course behind here is sort of 2,400 years of Western philosophy that I can't go into. So with respect to the question of consciousness, there's a wonderful quote from one of the philosophers who written a very important essay on the question by Thomas Nagel at NYU, and he makes this point: consciousness is what makes the mind-body problem really intractable, and try to explain why this is so. Without consciousness, the mind-body problem is sort of is almost trivial from a philosophical point of view or from a religious point of view, and with consciousness, it seems hopeless, at least to many. So that's why the general advice is don't dabble in consciousness before you get tenure. I actually did write my first paper on consciousness before I got tenure, but I had powerful friends in the form of my co-author Francis Crick, and since he's one of the Hall of Saints of biology, I still got tenure. So the problem is the following: that science explains many things very, very well. So, for example, you probably have all seen this. This was known in the popular press as the faith of God. So this was in 1992 when a satellite launched by NASA a couple of years before did a famous experiment called COBE. In fact, last year's Nobel Prize were awarded to Smoot at Berkeley and Barker at NASA for doing this experiment, where they measured the background radiation, the fluctuations in the background microwave radiation that are left over from the original Big Bang. That's a little bit like, so there's an explosion. This is the explosion that starts off everything you see, all of space-time, and you listen to the echoes, and you analyze sort of the detailed pattern of the echoes to try to infer something. And it led to what's now known as quantitative cosmology. We have pretty good models that tell us something about the earliest moment in the history of our universe, which is pretty spectacular, given that it happened a long, long time ago. We have since roughly more than 100 years, we have a very good understanding of everything we see, and we know how it's organized. It's organized in the structure known as the periodic table, and I mean, all of you recall this from high school. So everything we see or breathe or feel is organized into basic 92 different elements, and those 92 elements again subdivided in terms of other particles like electron, proton, neutron, and we can explain all of chemistry as an interaction of these various, of the electron, the outer shell, and how they interact. We can visualize individual atoms. What atomists could only dream and conceptualize about 2,200 years ago, we can now actually measure. We have tools like atomic force microscopy where we can measure actually individual atoms. This is a bunch of individual atoms, titanium atoms. And lastly, we have a pretty good understanding of the tree of life, how we evolve. We don't know all the details. We don't know really about the origin of life, how life originated, whether it was in a pond or whether it was in a volcano, the various scenarios. But we have a pretty good understanding of evolution, how we evolved from some bacteria 3.8 or something billion years ago, and then for, you know, 1 million, 2 million years, not much happened. We only evolved, into single-cell organism, and the entire explosion of the tree of life that gave rise to multicellular organism happened roughly 600 million years ago. And we're just one tiny point. There are roughly 2 million extant species, and we're just one tiny branch on that gigantic up there where the frog is, in fact, covered up by the rump of the frog. That's roughly where primates are, and we're just one particular branch, a leaf on that branch of primates. And so we understand the fundamental interrelatedness. We're all nature's children in some very real sense. We're all stardust in a very real sense, since the existence of heavy atoms in our bodies due to nuclear synthesis in supernova that burned on a long time ago. So in this sense, we're all interconnected. And we, in science, is beginning really to get a very good handle on all of this. Yet, we have no idea right now. Today, we have simple no idea how consciousness comes about. It is a fundamental mystery. So, and the philosophers have this term, they say, consciousness is not logical supervenient to physics. And never mind, it's just it's a complicated expression that I really don't quite understand. But at once upon a time I did understand it, but it's a terrible complicated process. But essentially it says that you can perfectly well imagine creatures like zombies. You can perfectly well imagine creatures like zombies without any consciousness. There's no law that tells us, in order to be a person like me, to be able to, in order for me to talk or to see or even to procreate, I need consciousness. Consciousness is something that isn't anywhere. You can look at evolution, you can look at the periodic system, you can chase down the origin of the universe. It's totally unclear how consciousness happens. It's like Aladdin rubs the lamp and suddenly the genie appears. That's exactly how consciousness appears right now to us. So, can we just briefly have the light off, please? The possible is to dim the lights.
Been here the whole time, and now
all right, it's not that important. What do you see here? What do you see? What do you all see?
Red.
Red. All right. So you're going to see slightly, you're going to see red, basically. It's going to depend exactly, like half of the guys out there, we know this now for a fact, roughly half of the guys will see this red slightly different than the other half of you guys. Why? Well, because it turns out there's a single nucleotide that's different in the photopigment, in the long-range photopigment in your eye. And this one tiny base pair difference makes up the fact that you see red, that half the guys see red slightly different than the other half the guys. But the point I want to demonstrate is this is what philosophers call as quelli. This is an elementary sensation. And the point is you see it, you have a feeling for it. I'm now not talking about the fact that if I ask you, is it red or blue, you can push a red button. I'm not asking you if you see red, there are going to certain processes take place in your brain. We know all of that. What I'd like to point out that all of these processes go hand in hand with a feeling. And that's the mysterious part. That's, we don't understand where that feeling comes from. So we know, for example, this is my brain, gorgeous, beautiful brain, I like to point out. Very elongated. I'm an egghead after all. So see some of this.
Can we go lights again now?
So you can see here, so for example, in this, you can put me in a magnet and you can make me look at a gray scene and you can make me look at a red scene, and then you can sort of do some numerical subtraction. You can essentially say, well, there's this part of the brain here that's specifically involved in the production of red. Right? Now, and I can do even more fancy experiments. I can now take microelectrodes and put into the brain of a monkey, like Jeff Schall is doing, or you can do it in patients. And I can even track down individual neurons that respond when you see red, and that don't respond when you don't see red. Now, all of that, we are doing that. Science is doing that. But all of that gives rise to what philosophers call as a third-person account. So I can tell you from the outside, when you see red, the following number of things will happen. The photoreceptors will be active in a certain way, and your neurons in your eye will be active in a certain way, and a part of the brain will be active in a certain way, and finally you'll say, I see red. But ultimately, what this list of things totally fails to capture is that you also see red. And if you're, in other words, if you have a brain, not only can you produce things like you can produce sounds like I do now and say I can see red, but you actually have feelings. And this is called the first person account. Right, so the third person of account of red is you make a list of all the things in my brain that happen when I see red. But the first person account is, and only I, somebody's having fun. and only I have this first person account. And all of this furious activity, all these neurons and all these brain cells also goes hand in hand with this activity called red. And it turns out many other things in my head can go on, many complicated things can go on, and Sigmund Freud first taught us that, can go on without any conscious experience whatsoever. And the question is, where's the difference? Why are certain types of activity, they give rise to this feeling of seeing red, and other types of activity do not give rise to this feeling? So if in a different context, it may be easier for you to imagine. So for example, when you think about, when I put my finger in a flame, it hurts. Right? We all know that. I mean, for most of us, it hurts. Now you can ask, why does it hurt? Well, the third person account is the neurons, the pain receptor in my finger, and they give rise to neural activity, and it travels up along to my spinal cord, and then it moves into cortex, and finally gives rise to some neurons firing, which means ultimately some ions are sloshing around my brain, potassium, chloride, whatever. And ultimately, this neural activity gives rise to feeling. Yet why should the movement of ions across molecular membranes, why should they give rise to this feeling? If you take my Macintosh, right, bless the computer system, if you take my Macintosh and you put a thermometer in it, and if the temperature increases above a certain degree, then I can get my Macintosh to print out, ouch, I'm in pain. But you're all going to say, well, that's not really pain. What that is, the electron that flow in a gate, and then the transistor switches, and it opens a register, and then it prints out pain. I know that there's no feelings associated with it, right? Yet, if I do it in me, I know I have feelings, and if I do it in you, I don't know for 100% that you have feelings. I mean, you could be a zombie, but I assume, by and large, we assume because you behave like me, and your brain is very similar to me, and you're born from a mother and a father just like I am, I assume that you also have the same subjective state, that you also have this feeling. But where the feeling comes from, we're not really sure. So the term that philosophers use is qualia, qualia. So what's common to all of these different persons, when you see a red sunset, or you see the flag of red China, or you see red Mars, the planet, or you see an amethyst, or you see blood, what's common to all of that is this person of red. And this is what a philosopher refers as the quality of red. That's a quality for being angry. It's a quality for being me. It's a quality for being, you know, for hearing a high tone. There's a quality for being, you know, sad or depressed or to be a man living in a post-feminist, post-industrialist, late capitalist society. So for all these different feelings, simple or more complicated, there's always, for all these different states, there's something feeling associated with that. And the question is, how do these qualities come into the world? So could I have the lights off once again? Sorry. So this is a simple experiment. I'll show you a lot more tomorrow. But what you should do is you should just fixate the cause here. Just look at the central cause and don't move your eyes. Keep them open, both of them. And don't move your eyes and tell me what you see. All right, you should all see a big blue sphere, right? What else do you see? Don't move your eyes. Yes? Hello? All right, do you see that? That the yellow dots flicker in and out of existence?
Yes.
No. Okay, you should come see me afterwards. No, it's a demo. I mean, we can do much better in the lab. But what you should see, if you really keep your eyes steady, that's one, and sometimes both of the yellow squares totally disappear, briefly, for 2-3 seconds, then they reappear. Now you got to trust me. I'm a scientist. I don't fool around. The yellow squares are present all the time on the screen. I'm not messing with you. In fact, you can ask your neighbor, and she may see these things disappear very different from when you see them disappear. So here we have a simple practical, operational definition of consciousness. Because sometimes you see the yellow, you're conscious of it. You can talk to the yellow about the yellow to your neighbor. It reminds you of, I don't know, the yellow sunflower of Van Gogh and other things, and sometimes they're just not there. They're present on your retina, but just like in a magic show, the magician, you're looking at them, you don't see them, you're not conscious of them. And so you can now ask a very simple question. What's the difference in the brain when you are conscious of the yellow compared to all the times when you're not conscious of the yellow? It's a simple question you can ask in a lab, for example. All right, so the heart of the mind-body problem is that we're trying to address is this. What is the exact nature of the relationship between this conscious immaterial mind and the relationship between this immaterial conscious mind, the things I feel that seem to be ephemeral but are very real to me, and the physical basis in the electrochemical interaction in the body. Somehow, out of those physical interactions in my body, specifically in my brain, not in my heart, for example, as Aristotle thought, but in my brain, somehow consciousness must happen. But how does it happen? We don't know. And why does it happen, for example, only in the brain, only up here? Some of you may know, down here in your gut, there's a complicated nervous system called the enteric nervous system. There are roughly 100 million neurons down here. And most of the time, you have no idea what they do. In fact, you don't want to know, because when they do tell you, usually you get nauseated or something like that, right? You don't really want to know down there what happens in the plumbing. But the fact is, there are 100 million neurons there, and they do all their work in total silence, in total phenomenological silence. You take another complex biological system, the immune system, works very well, protects us almost our entire lives from attack, from viruses, bacteria, and other sources. Yet it works totally in the dark. I have no fear. In fact, we didn't even know it existed until 120 years ago, right? So there are many cases of complicated biological networks that do all their work in without any feelings whatsoever. And so you can ask yourself, why do we have feelings? Wouldn't it be, certainly it's compatible with everything we know about physics and chemistry and biology, that we could do everything we do without being conscious. But here we are, we find ourselves in this world, we can experience things, which is a wonderful gift, and the question is, where does it come from? My microphone is waxing and waning all the time, right? Maybe I just have to keep it lower. All right, now, so this is the key problem. What's the nature of the relationship between conscious sensation and the mind and the physical brain? Also, we'd like to know, there are all sorts of questions that we would like to know further. So why are there any feelings at all? Why can't we just all work without any feelings whatsoever? Where do qualia come from? And some of the related problems are, there are different feelings. Like there's feeling of red, which is different from the feeling of green and blue and yellow. But these are not random things, they're all arranged. In fact, they're arranged in a circle, as you might well know if you do drawing. And these feelings are very different than the feelings of hearing, or the feelings of smelling, or the feelings of having a burning sensation, or the feeling of angry. So what's these are not arbitrary things, these are all well-ordered feelings. How do they get there, the ordered structure? Why are feelings private? Right? We know it's very difficult to communicate true feelings, true love to somebody else. How do I know that I, how do you know that you really love me? How do you know that I'm not just pretending to love you, right? That's what poetry, half of poetry and country song is all about. How do these feelings acquire meaning? These feelings are not just random symbols. Red isn't just a random symbol. They all seem to be well connected. And when you think about red, there's this rush of association you get, right? Same thing when you hear tone or when you hear music, there's this rush of association that comes with it, explicit and implicit. How does this happen? One of the most interesting questions, particularly for neuroscientists and also for clinicians, is only some brain states are associated with feelings. Most of the time, most of what happens in our brain, we have no idea it's happening. So for example, when you talk, like this, when you give a public talk, you may not believe it, but most of you who've given talks know this. I have no idea what I'm going to say, usually, until I hear what's coming out of my mouth. I have a rough idea, I know the slides I'm going to show you, and I know roughly what I'm saying, but it's not that I, Christoph, sitting inside here saying, okay, the next sentence, has to be this, and then, of course, it's in German, and then I translate it and send it out. It doesn't happen like that. These things just come out of my mouth. But this is true for almost everything. When I open my eyes, I see instantly, in fact, not instantly, but a few hundred milliseconds, I see the world in color, in great depth, and no amount of psychoanalysis, no amount of, lying down on a couch and paying $200 an hour will ever enable me to introspect. How do I see? I just see. It just happens automatically. It's this beautiful design interface. It just happens. So when you run, when you play tennis, when you climb, when you dance, when you play soccer, when you do football, when you do all these high sensory motor activities, particularly if they're well trained, you do them best if you don't reflect upon them. In fact, research has shown, and every coach will tell you this, when you really perform it, when you're in the flow, you don't want to think about what you're doing, because when you think about doing it, you're interrupting the flow, and your performance will drop. So here we have many cases of very high functioning a performance that it that goes on in the absence of consciousness, or consciousness only happens after the fact. And so we can ask the question functionally, why are certain states associated with consciousness and others not? We can also ask in the brain, why did that activity, some type of neural activity gives rise to consciousness, but other types not? What's going on there? So there's a problem that relates to this, but it's really in some sense orthogonal, and I won't talk too much about it. And it's epitomized by this. You remember this movie, Dr. Strangelove? You know, where the guy does this, and then in the next scene, So this relates to the question of free will. And certainly most of us, most of the time, you know, unless we are drunk or under duress or on drugs or clinically dissociated or something, we have the feeling that we're really free. You know, I'm free to raise my hand or not to raise my hand. You didn't make me raise my hand. My parents didn't make me raise my hand. You know, I raised my hand of my own free will. Yet from a philosophical point of view, the question of free will is profoundly troubling. Because as Immanuel Kant and many other people have argued, the universe is causally closed, which means everything in the universe is caused by something else in the universe. Very, in fact, there has to be a cause, and you can trace this chain of causal chain back ultimately to the beginning. So the question is, where does free will come in? Now, whether or not free will exists, like I said, I'll talk about it separately, is a fascinating question. It really goes to the core of who we think we are, how we should behave. Right, without free will, there's really, at least I'm a Catholic, in a Catholic sense, there's no idea of sin. Our legal system partly is based upon the idea of free will. The question of whether or not free will is illusionary is really, in some sense, separated from the question of consciousness. You can well imagine that free will is an illusion, that there is no such free will. That doesn't impact really the question of consciousness. It doesn't really impact the question of how does consciousness enter into the natural world. And you can still ask the question, what is, for example, the correlate of the feeling philosophers call this agency, right? The fact that I am my own agent, that I'm responsible for lifting up this bottle, and that there's a conscious sensation. You can study the neural basis of that. But that's really separate from the question of free will. And so I think today and tomorrow I'll leave that out, because it's not related to this other. So the mind-body are really two core questions. One is the question of the nature of consciousness and its relationship to the physical world. And the other aspect is the nature of will. Now, you should remember these, because I'll ask you, we'll hand out questionnaires at the end. These are the sum of the different philosophical positions that people have held for the last two centuries, roughly, on consciousness. Wonderful, a lot of list of isms, and I'm not going to go into them. And people always ask me, what sort of ism do I hold? Am I a monist, a dualist, or a proto-dualist, or a weak epistemological dualist, or an idealist? Or these are all positions that people heatedly defend, I'm not a philosopher, I'm not going to go into that. I'm just going to draw two or three main philosophical traditions, particularly in the Anglo-Saxon tradition, and how they relate to the interest I'm interested, to the things I, as scientists, can say about the world. So before we come to that, you're probably going to say, how can this scientist talk about consciousness without having a definition of consciousness? Now, traditionally, if you look at science, in fact, almost always progressed without making rigorous definitions. The definitions that in a textbook usually come in later, they come in after the fact. You may have seen recently there was this discovery of new planets, right, by Michael Brown at Caltech Mountain University. So people have now, the International Astronomical Union has redefined what a planet was. And so you may have heard that the planet you learned in grade school, Pluto, isn't a planet anymore, right? It's just got demoted to a minor planet. It's not officially a planet anymore. So even something as big as macroscopic, we thought we all assured that planets, you know, we can clearly define them, but suddenly the definition have changed. So it's just an example that definitions are very slippery things, and usually you should only define definition once you really understand things. But you want to have a rough definition, and as scientists, you want to have a working definition that you're willing to modify. So there are different definitions you can make of consciousness. So one is the common sense one, right? If I climb, I fall on a climb, on a lead climb, you fall, and suddenly everything goes black. Gone. Nothing. Absolutely nothing anymore. There's no sensation it's no sensation of black, because black, of course, is a sensation like any other sensation. You just feel nothing. And then at some point, you wake up. you know, usually, I mean, fortunately, only a couple of minutes later, and you have all your friends, you know, looking at you, what's going on, you try to understand what happened, all right? So in that time, before when I climbed, I was exquisitely conscious, and then when you fall, you hit your head, suddenly you're not conscious anymore, right? So that's a common, that's a very common sense definition. The other definition is each of you, every night, hopefully, you will become unconscious, meaning in deep sleep. Right? In deep sleep, you become unconscious. They'll wake you up from a deep sleep. You know, you don't report anything, just nothing. You don't report black, you don't report anything. Now, if it's in a different part of a sleep, you dream, called REM sleep, you're highly awake, you're highly conscious. It's not the same consciousness as being wakeful, but you're highly conscious. And so you can see another definition of consciousness, whatever is there during day and goes away in deep sleep, or goes away when I get hit on the head, or goes away in deep anesthesia. So that's one common sense definition. Another definition is that's less useful, but that philosophers use a lot. A conscious state is a state that is about something. Right? So the conscious state is about me, being Christoph, or the conscious state is about being pain, or about seeing red. So that it's about something. This is a definition that many philosophers have used. You can use a behavioral definition, beloved by psychologists, and this is a little bit like a Turing test. You may have heard of a Turing test. A Turing test is a test, it's a game invented by Alan Turing, the British computer scientist, to define what is intelligence. So he said, people at this time had all long protracted debate, what does it mean for a machine to be conscious? And he said, well, let's forget about the definition, let's do a practical test. I put you in one room, I put something else in the other room, and curiously here the question, the original paper, the question, you had to decide whether the other person you were talking to was a male or female. If you couldn't do that, you had to admit, if this other entity, so you could ask this entity any question. You can ask them about poetry and about politics, science, anything. And then you have to decide, so today's modified, you could play it online during games. The thing is you play over teletype, you play against the software, against something, and you don't know whether the something you're playing against is another human or is a computer program. If you cannot, after a reasonable time, decide whether the something is a computer or a human, then you've got to say, well, whatever it is, at least it's intelligent. And we want Turing tests that don't relate to intelligence, because intelligence and consciousness are not the same thing, most emphatically. Intelligence and consciousness are not the same thing. We have something called self-consciousness, but that's just one aspect of consciousness, and self-consciousness relates to intelligence. But seeing or smelling or feeling angry, those are states that don't really relate in any direct way to consciousness. So we'd like a behavioral test that tells us this person is conscious. Now, of course, in human, we all know, a simple test. I ask you, how are you doing? Now, of course, if you're very drunk or if you're stupid, you may just say, right? And so, you know, so you can't just use simple reflex. It has to be more sophisticated. But if I ask you a sophisticated question, like what's your opinion of George W. Bush and his performance over the last 6 years, and you give me an answer, then I assume that you're conscious. Now, of course, what happens if you have a stroke? I didn't talk about the level of performance. I can ask you, what happens if you have a stroke? Because then you can't talk anymore. Well, it gets a little bit complicated. What happens in an infant, let's say an infant of 1 year old, right, who can't talk yet, or what happens to a newborn, right? Or what about a fetus, you know, in 36, a premature born baby that cannot talk at all? They can't talk, so are they conscious? So clearly language isn't good enough. Now, what about an animal? You know, most animals or animals don't talk, of course. I mean, non-human animals don't talk, and so we need some other behaviors that can generalize across patients, across people, and across animal species to test whether the subject is conscious or not. Brain-based, so you can go, it's of great practical concern. People like, you saw it a couple of years ago, people like Terry Schiavo, we'd like a brain-based definition of consciousness. We like to know when a patient comes in, it looks like in a coma or persistent vegetative state or minimal conscious state or stupor. We like to have some definition based on the brain, that's what I specialize in that tells us, based on this definition, if these brain structures are intact, the person or the subject is conscious. And lastly, we want a theory. What we really need, what we strive for, is a theory of consciousness, because ultimately, we like to know, we like to have some sort of understanding. Right now, we don't have it at all. We like to know which systems are conscious. Right? So we'd like to know, what makes a human conscious, at what point. It's probably not all or none, it's probably graded, but that's a question that has to be answered. We'd like to know, is a fetus conscious? We'd like to know, practical question, this person that I anesthetize, at least I paralyzed, and I partly anesthetize, is that person unconscious? We'd like to know it for animals. you know, we like to know, is a bee conscious? Is a monkey conscious? Is a dog conscious? And lastly, we want to have a theory that tells us, well, can we possibly construct entities that are conscious? What about the internet? What about a Macintosh computer? What about a Windows machine? A lot of pain. Right, so ultimately, we want, just like anywhere else in science, we need a theoretical justified theory for which systems are conscious and why they're conscious. And we don't know yet whether there will be such a theory. We just don't know. And very often, science, you know, you don't know until you get there. Some people, of course, say there will never be such a theory. We don't know. Right, this is the only text I have, the only long text I have. It's from John Tyndall, who's a physicist, an Irish physicist, who I think was head of the British Society for the Advancement of Science in the second part of the 19th century. And he's the guy who first correctly explained why the sky is blue. And he's written this wonderful passage that, although it's now 140 years old, basically, exactly, it could be written today. So I can read it. The passage from the physics of the brain to the corresponding facts of consciousness is unthinkable as a result of mechanics. Today we'd say molecular biology, neuroscience. Granted that a definite thought and a definite molecular action in the brain occurs simultaneously, we do not possess intellectual organ, nor apparently any rudiment of the organ, which would enable us to pass by a process of reasoning from the one phenomenon to the other. So on the one hand, we have the physics of the brain. On the other hand, we have conscious experience. And how do you get from one to the other? They appear together, but we do not know why. Were our minds and our senses so expanded, strengthened, and illuminated as to enable us to see and feel the very molecules of the brain, which we can do now? Were we capable of following all the emotions, all the groupings, all the electrical discharges, if such there be? And were we intimately acquainted with the corresponding states of thought and feeling, we should be as far as ever from the solution of the problem, how are these physical processes connected with the facts of consciousness? The chasm between the two classes of phenomena would still remain intellectually impassable. Let the consciousness for love, for example, be associated with the right-handed spiral motion of molecules of the brain, and the consciousness of hate with the left-handed spiral motion. We should then know when we love that the motion is in one direction, and when we hate that the motion is the other direction. But the why would remain as unanswered as before. So the big question for me as a scientist, will we ever be in this sorry state? Or at some point, will we be able to answer his question, his lack of understanding in a precise way? We don't know. All right, so these two gentlemen are probably the two philosophers who certainly influenced Western thought, in particular Western Christian thought, more than anybody else, besides St. Paul, from the School of Athens by Raphael. It hangs in my office. This is Plato pointing upward, and this is Aristotle pointing downward. So surrounded by the other Greek philosophers and mathematicians and scientists. So one very popular position that, in fact, if you count humanity on the planet, I would say the vast majority of people have a sort of one or another form of dualism, which is what we call also the Platonic ideas argued for. So he argued for the idea that there's an immortal and immaterial soul, and it's imprisoned in a mortal and material body. So the body is mortal, it's going to die, we all know that. And the body is made of material, and the soul is immortal, and is immaterial. And this is this is what we call dualism. That essentially two sorts of stuff. There's matter, and then there's the soul. Now, what exactly he meant by soul is sometimes difficult, and what the Greek meant by soul, because you're interpreting stuff over 2,300 years, and you know the very basic facts of life have changed. So, for instance, in some writing, not with Plato, but with others, very often with soul, they also meant the spirit of life, which, of course, today we consider as totally separate. As we see, for example, Terry Schiavo. Terry Schiavo was clearly alive, and the tragedy of many of these people in persistent vegetative status, I'll talk more about it tomorrow, that they can be alive even by themselves, yet as far as we can tell, they're not conscious at all. So clearly we know that the property of life is separate from the property of consciousness, which at the time very often was not clear. So, for example, if you go in the old Aramaic, if you read the Old Testament, for example, the term nefesh can be translated either as soul or as life. So I personally find it very difficult, and of course, a legion of scholars who specialize in doing interpretation of Bible and other sources, and it's very difficult. You always end up rereading in your interpretation as seen 2,300 years later. Be that as it may, this very powerful intellectual influence of Plato came to us via the Neoplatonic and via St. Augustine. So this Hellenistic tradition found its way into Christian theology, particularly into Roman Catholic thinking, and then also in the world at large. So most people believe, certainly in the United States, believe that they have a soul, the soul is immortal, and that consciousness is intimately tied up with the soul. Now, the soul was not only evoked to explain life, including, by the way, if you could look at René Descartes, but also to invoke other things that we don't tend to associate with the soul anymore, things like rational thought, language, and free will. In particular, because, of course, at the time, they had no idea how a machine could produce rational thought. I mean, that's only 17th and 18th century. So partly this early conception of soul is really something that's not only the metaphysical, religious aspect of soul, but also a lot of other things associated with the idea of soul, including the life principle itself and rational thought and language, things that we do not tend to associate. So it's really interesting, if you care about this history, and I'm certainly interested in this, the idea of dualism and the immortality of the soul, versus, so there are some ways, for example, you can read Thomas Aquinas, particular, where you can read the almost pathomonistic belief that in the sense that if you die, and your soul, what he calls souls, which he subdivides into various faculty, also dies with you, but then at the end of time, God resurrects you. So in that sense, there is no true dualism, but your body's resurrected in your body. So it's interesting, for the past 2,000 years, the readings of the exact relationship of the soul or the conscious aspect of the soul to the body has really changed a lot. And then we come to the most powerful, certainly intellectual influence in modern intellectual, in academic life, was René Descartes, who in 1637, he worked on it for many years, it's what we call today Cartesian dualism, which is, he really says that's very clear, there's two sorts of stuff. Everything in the universe falls into two divisions. There's matter, which he called res extens, it has extension, this is matter, and this is res extens, and my brain is res extens, and all animals have it, and our bodies are made out of it. But then in addition, he was very explicit about this, animals do not have res cogitans, we have res cogitans. Res cogitans, as you can hear from the root cognition, is thinking stuff, thinking substance. And only we have that. So he assumed that the intelligence shown by a dog can be done. So at the time, it's interesting, the dominant technology in the 17th century was, of course, the fountains and the water place at Versailles, you know, where the king lived. And they had these very fancy, they had these mechanized sort of, it's like simple robots, and they had these little plays where the gods in these fountains could perform various actions, all driven by hydrodynamics. So he was imagining that the same thing happened in our bodies. And he was an anatomist. He actually dissected organism, which of course we think today is totally wrong, but that was the technology of his times. So he said explicitly, animals don't have this cogitant stuff that only humans have. So he says human bodies are consist of the same stuff that animals have. They have this machine stuff, but then in addition, they are built to think and to be rational, and also the idea of a soul comes to us in the form of it's mediated by this res cogitans. Now this is a very appealing position, and most of us intuitively, certainly at some point in our life, we have that because that's our experience. The experience I have is that inside here, in fact, I can exactly tell you here, between your two eyes, I'm sitting, right? The little Christoph who's sitting inside there, and the Christoph is sitting outside looking at the world, and Christoph is making all the decisions. And Christoph is sort of, that's my real me. And this is the feeling I have. It's a very overwhelming feeling, and we all have it. And so it makes sense to say, yeah, this Christoph is formed out of slightly different material, it's ephemeral, and that's what makes that's what gives me the aspect of the soul. Now, I don't know about souls, but whatever I do know, that we have never found, if you look at brains, there's really no distinction between us and animals. The distinction is more of a kind than it is, it's more quantitative than it is qualitative. So whatever it is, it must also, the animals must also have it. And if you read him closely, you have the feeling that the main reason he made this assertion, this is controversial among scholars today, is that he made this partly out of the defense. He was terribly scared after Galileo's work was put on the index, and he, you know, was put in front of the Holy the Inquisition. René Descartes became very scared, and it's unclear to what extent he really believed this, that animals don't have it. He certainly believed this dualism, but to what extent he really believed that animals didn't have it, or to what extent he was following the beliefs of the church at the time for fear of prosecution is a little bit unclear. All right, so in modern form, this is an Australian famous Australian philosopher called David Chalmers, and he published a very successful book called The Conscious Mind. And in this book, he was essentially arguing for a modern form of dualism. It's called weak epistemological dualism, right? Because he doesn't believe in soul, and I think he's an atheist, but he really says that the universe is made of two sorts of stuff. There's all this stuff that we can measure called physicalism, all the forces of nature and, you know, particles and energy fields and all of that. But in addition, certain systems, certain information processing systems have additional property, information processing property, and each information processing system feels like something. That's just the way the universe is. So it's just like in the 18th century or the early 19th century, we had to introduce this new entity into the world called magnetic force. Just like today, we have to realize in order to completely describe the universe, we also have to include this subjective aspect. It's associated with information. And he called it, he said there are really two problems to solve. There's an easy problem to solve, which is what Jeff and I and other neuroscientists do, which is how does the brain integrate information? How does it remember things? And you can do a lot of work, and you have to, you know, crush up the body, look at the molecules, and put people in scanners and all of that. That's the easy problem, because from an epistemological point of view, it's not particularly difficult. It may be practically difficult, it's going to take us 100 years, but it's not easy from a philosophical point of view. Then there's what he calls a hard problem, which is not hard like this. This is one of the most spectacular points in American climbing. It's called the Thanks God Ledge on 1,800 feet up Half Dome. When you look there, you look down 1,800 feet of spectacular nothingness below you. Anyhow, that's a hard problem in climbing. What he meant is the hard problem that he calls, the hard problem is why is this brain activity associated with an experience in our life? Again, it's a key problem. It's a problem I kept on referring to. So he thinks this problem ultimately cannot be addressed by reduction science. The only way it can be attacked is by postulating a set of laws and then essentially saying, well, the world just is this way. There's the physics of the universe, which includes my body, and then certain of these states of certain information processing system, including my body, including a computer, including a light switch. These what call the panpsychist. He associates every information processing system, whether it's as simple as a light switch or a complex, this has this inner core, has this inner quality associated with it. He said that that's just the way the universe is. So, you know, there's a feeling for expressing this. Very complicated conscious state. Mm-hmm. All right, let's skip that. Now, this is just a clip I took a couple of days ago. I'm also a professor of engineering. We do computer vision. And so here you have a computer system that attends to these different things here and then analyzes what it is and recognizes it. It calls it a fractal book or Amnesty International Journal or PEN or this other book. Now the question is, and it seems to perform reasonably well, it does it almost in real time at 16 frames per second. So the question is, does this computer actually feel? It's just a different way of reforming the problem. And we would say no, this system can process, can have behavior, you can attach a moving eye to it, we'll have a demo of VSS, so it looks like it can actually see, but we don't think there's any conscious sensation associated with it. So, but again, the problem with us is when we look at things, when we see this gentleman on this book, Fractals, we have conscious sensation associated with it. Now, the other strong tradition in philosophy is this one, particularly epitomized by a very famous, brilliant philosopher called Dan Leonard at Tuft. And he published this book where he says, I've explained the problem. I like this philosopher, they're not at all humble, many of them. He's explained it, he says, essentially, you're basically confused about it. I mean, it's more complicated than that, but essentially comes down to there is, fundamentally is nothing to explain this. Ultimately, well, what he says, what we have to explain is the psychological and sociological observation that some people claim they're conscious, particularly non-philosophers. But once you're properly educated, once you think about it, you realize it's just a gigantic illusion, it's just a huge confusion. There just isn't anything like conscious pain. You may feel awful about it, you may want to run away when you have a toothache, you may want to bury your head, but ultimately it doesn't feel like anything. I had this correspondence with him after I had to abort one of my climbs because I had this terrible, terrible pain. And as you all know, when you are in pain, it's the single most overwhelming, when it's really bad pain, overwhelming feeling you have sensation. And to say, well, sorry, Christoph, you're just confused, there really isn't anything like pain, just doesn't cut it when you have pain. So I don't know. So it is a tradition. It's a powerful tradition of life today that says there really isn't anything special to explain. What you have to explain are behavioral dispositions. You have to explain why people say this, they're conscious, but there really isn't anything special. There isn't any particular problem to explain for consciousness. Now, of course, here I fall back to René Descartes, who one of the most brilliant and certainly most famous deduction in modern Western thought said, I can doubt everything. I can doubt that I'm alive. I can doubt that I'm dreaming. I can doubt that I'm a man, 47 years old, however he was at the time. But what I cannot doubt, because I think, therefore I am. Je suis, je pense, donc je suis. That is actually in French, not in Latin. It only came later. Right? We know it as cogito ergo sum. So fundamentally, I feel, and therefore I am. The most. And so this is always what I come back to. This is the most central state of our existence. The fact that I can, the only way I experience the universe, the only way I know about the universe is because I experience the universe. And therefore, if science wants to have a complete understanding of the universe, we have to include consciousness in it. Lastly, there's also a position known as the mysterian position. That's not the formal term, but we call it that, which is that essentially consciousness will never be understood. For all sorts of reasons, partly for principal reasons. What chance does an ant have of understanding general relativity? Right? Our brain just isn't constructed to understand itself. Of course, a very defeatist position that I don't share at all. I mean, self-defeating, right? If you think, you know, then we're wasting our time here. All right, so the pragmatic position I'll talk more about tomorrow is the following. That if you look at the brain, one thing that strikes you, which is the theme that people are pursuing, that it's a highly hierarchical system. Basically, you can go from the scale of synapses, which is sort of a fraction of a micrometer, to a scale of at least a meter, if we leave out sociology, if we just look at a single person. That's roughly a meter. That's roughly 6 orders of magnitude. And we know it's hierarchical at many, many different scales. Here's a view of the parts of the brain. Each one of these boxes is a little part of the brain, and they're all wired together in very intricate ways. And somehow consciousness is associated with, so this is very neutral language, is associated with certain hierarchical, highly interconnected biological networks. We don't know whether it has to be associated with biological networks. As I mentioned before, it may be possible that the internet at some point is going to become conscious. We don't know. But certainly right now we can say for sure certain types of brains, certain types of networks have this property of consciousness. Now, there's a very popular position that for which there's really no evidence that in modern times epitomized by this brilliant physicist, Roger Penrose, who among others invented Penrose tiles, invented the never-ending staircase. So he said that we really need to involve quantum mechanics, essentially, that in order to really understand consciousness, we need to go to quantum gravity theory, which is another 12 orders of magnitude below. That the only way to understand consciousness is to have a theory of quantum gravity, which we don't have, and then they're both mysteries, and then one mystery is linked with the other one. Well, maybe yes, it's difficult to disprove these things, but right now there's just no hint of evidence. One key problem is, at 300 degrees Kelvin, the ambient temperature of the brain is a very hot system by quantum mechanical standards. And we know that when people are now trying to build quantum computers, it's exceedingly difficult. We can only build systems with a very small number of qubits, and we have to usually do it at temperatures of liquid helium. So this is the brain's really the worst possible place to look for microscopic quantum mechanical effects. But it's a very popular theory, partly because it's wonderful mysterious. It's all quantum interconnected. And then you can cite Schrödinger's cat, and it all sounds wonderful. I mean, yeah, I wish, but you know, there's really no evidence for it right now. Okay, a few other points I'd like to make before I finish. So A, language is important for us, of course. Without language, we're not really humans. But it enriches consciousness, no question. It makes many things possible, but there's no evidence, really, that you need language to be conscious of anything. And partly this problem, and as I mentioned before, there are lots of subjects, including babies and patients and animals, that are conscious, and yet they can't talk. And partly this comes from a point of view of philosophers who are terrible self-conscious, and who write books that dominate the fields, and so they constantly introspect, and therefore they get an idea that self-reflection and self-consciousness is the most important aspect of consciousness, but it's only one aspect of consciousness. When you're playing soccer out there, when you're running, or when you're climbing, or when you're driving very quickly, you really have to pay attention. You're not, when you're in a movie or reading an absorbing book, you're not sitting there, okay, I'm now watching an exciting movie, right? You just enjoy it, you're just in it, right? You experience life, and then language isn't really necessary for those sorts of things. Three dogs. Who was? Three dogs. Now, for all of you who have cats and dogs, this is probably a non-issue, but for some who don't, it may be an issue, that these guys are actually conscious, right? The German Shepherd, a mix in a Kuvas. Now, why do I say that these are conscious? So, first of all, the position that most biologists have, that many species besides us are conscious. We're not saying the conscience of a dog is the same as conscience of us. There's no question about it, they're not. We are much more complicated. We can reflect upon ourselves. We can reflect upon our death and about tax and about all sorts of things dogs can. But if you just look at simple perception of pain, of pleasure, of joy, of depression, of anger, of certainly simple emotion, of jealousy, most mammals, we share this. Why do we say this? Well, A, we're closely evolutionary related. B, our behaviors are very similar, right? If you have a dog in pain, the dog will yelp, the dog will vocalize, the dog may limp, the dog may call away, the dog may come to you for consolation, the dog winces. There's very similar things that you do. I mean, the dog can't talk, but otherwise behavior is very similar. And we know the nervous system is terribly similar to ours. In fact, if I take a little grain of brain tissue, we'll take an expert here, like for example John Cass here at Vanderbilt, to tell the difference between a grain of human, a grain of, if I take a grain of brain chunk, brain matter, to say, is this brain matter from a human, from a monkey, from a mouse, or from a dog? They're all very, very similar. The size, is different, but then we know size isn't everything. but the basic structure is very similar. So for all these reasons, most of us find it obvious and find it confirmed in behavior that animals, some animals are also conscious. So the distinctiveness of human is more a question of degree. Yes, we can talk, and animals by and large can talk, although it's a little bit controversial with chimps, but you can find almost anything, you can find precursor in animals. And the really interesting thing for us is we don't really know the simplest animal that consciousness. So most people are willing to say, okay, dogs are conscious, and cats are also conscious. All cute creatures, most people tend to associate, teddy bears, of course, koala bears are conscious. But then when you come to birds, it's a little bit more controversial. And then particularly if you come to things like bees, you say, well, come on, give me a break, that's just a bug, right? You can step on it. But if you look at bees, so I don't do that anymore. Why? Because if you look at bees, if you look at their complicated behavior, the way they can fly down mazes, you can train bees, for example, to do the following thing. You train them to fly into a maze. At the entry of a maze, you have a red signal. At the branch point, when you come to a Y, they have one of red, one has a red light, the other one a green light. And if at the entrance of the maze is red, they remember red, and at every turn, they take the red turn. So they come to several branch points, each time it's a red light and a green light, they will always take the branch with a red light. Then the next time, you switch from red, green to horizontal, vertical. So at the entrance is vertical, then they remember vertical, and at each branch point, they take the exit that's marked vertical. I mean, it's pretty amazing. And so right now, we just do not know. We don't have a theory, and we have intuitions, but that may be totally wrong, about which animals are conscious and not. And so right now we just don't know. Okay, this I'll show tomorrow. So what I'll talk about tomorrow is, so tomorrow I'll talk about the program. I'll show you the video of Francis, and I'll talk about this program that people are now following, where you want to study the neural basis of consciousness. But I realize I'm running out of time. So for those who are skeptic that this program will ever work, that following the neural base of consciousness will ever be successful, I found, this is my last slide, I found this wonderful quote in a book review that somebody wrote, that Bateson, in fact, introduced modern genetics to England, and in fact, he introduced the term genes and genetics. So he reviewed during the Great War, he reviewed the book of the American Thomas and Morgan, who at the time was at Columbia before he went to Caltech. And he started the experiments on flies and the genetic code, using different colored flies with different colored eyes. And so he, in this book, essentially said that genetic information is stored along one-dimensional strings, which we now know to be true. But then he says, but I don't understand how this is supposed to work. It's just totally baffles me, and it calls for some new laws or something. So Bateson, who was also materialist, and Thomas and Morgan, who was materialist, this is what he has to say. The properties of living things are in some way attached to the material basis, perhaps in some special degree to nuclear chromatin, i.e. the chromosomes. And yet it is inconceivable that particles of chromatin of any other substance, however complex, can possess those powers which must be assigned to our factors or genes. The supposition that chromosomes, indistinguishable from each other, indeed
almost,
of course this is a killer word, right?
Yeah.
Almost homogeneous under any known test, can by their material nature confer all the properties of life, surpasses the range of even the most convinced materialism. So the problems they had, they said at the time, we understand chemistry, because they didn't know about macromolecules, they didn't know about the amazing specificity of protein, which was exactly the problem. They didn't know it, so therefore they called, some people said, well, this calls for new laws, like Schrödinger said in his book, What is Life? It calls for new philosophical principles, vitalism, right? Yet in fact, what turned out in this case, you could explain, we think we explain life. Now, we don't know whether consciousness is going to be of that nature. We just don't know right now. It's an open problem. Will it also, ultimately, will we have a lecture 100 years from now where people say, well, clearly this is how consciousness works? Or will we be 100 years a lot further along the third person account that we can tell you exactly which neurons and which molecules are involved when I see red and when I have pain? But ultimately, in 100 years, my successor will still swap his hand and say, well, I don't know, ultimately, activity he is associated with his conscious feelings. We can't really say anything more. With that, I'll leave you. Thank you very much. Yeah, the questions. Anything I haven't...